like my roommate. Welcome. You are in the Senate Education and Workforce Committee. If you're in the wrong place, now is your time to exit. If you have a cell phone, please turn it off or turn it on vibrate. If you do not, and I hear it, you will be making a contribution to the Common School Fund. And as the session wears on, that contribution amount gets higher and higher because we need it. Yeah. We do. We do. We are going to take SCR 4 out of order because Senator Carter is here and that bill shouldn't take very long. And then we're going to have a fabulous presentation today on financial literacy. But before we get to that, we're going to hear all about this fabulous bill. And Marguerite, tell us about it.
In the public hearing, Madam Chair?
Oh, yeah. We're in a public hearing on SCR 4. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill SCR 4 commemorates Concordia University for 100 years of service and education. In your packet, you have the Dash 2 amendment that was proposed or drafted by Senator Carter's office on behalf of Concordia University. And I know that Senator Carter is here to testify.
Great. Thank you, Senator Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Margaret Carter, House District 22, North Northeast Portland. I am very, very pleased to ask you today as a committee to for a concurrent resolution, SCR 4, in commemoration of the 100th anniversary, Senator Deckard, on behalf of Concordia University. It's a great little liberal arts school in North Northeast Portland, graced by big, tall trees, beautiful campus, housing for students who come from all over the world to that little small campus. It has become an anchor in our community, and it certainly is an integral part of the neighborhood in which we live. I have visited that campus on many occasions, and it's very inspiring to see so many of the young people, even though it's a Christian school, they are involved in a lot of programs outside of the institution in the community to look at the educational implications in society today, as well as political implications. And they have lyceum programs on campus for politicians and other education groups to come and speak to the students on campus, and it's quite an exciting place to be. They also just dedicated a library to the school that has a large volume for school. Its size, I can't remember the volume size of it at this moment, but the university offers a variety of undergraduate programs in liberal arts and nursing, along with healthcare administration and business, as well as graduate degrees in education, business and school administration. They're very good at bringing the community to the inside of the school, and they have set themselves up in terms of high standards in this community and across the nation in terms of Lutheran schools. In sports, the university fields a number of fine teams, including soccer and basketball, and I might add, within the recent past, Division I NCAA basketball, they themselves managed to place pretty high there as well. And this is a school that is rising in the West, and I really want us to be a part of being able to say to schools in Oregon, good job, and we like the fact that you have set yourself aside and apart as being a very good, very well-run institution. So that's why I'm asking you to join me in the commemorating of Concordia University on its 100th anniversary. There will be a wider community celebration, including a visit to our state chamber, the Senate chamber, and they're going to bring the choir here on March the 30th, and the President of the University and the Chair of the Board of Regents will be visiting as well. So I ask you to not only help me to welcome them, but also to, if any of you have some time, they're going to be doing a community-wide service day in Northeast Portland on April the 5th, and it will be a celebratory graduation exercise that will draw visitors from across the nation. I will be helping to rally those young people to go out to be involved in service to our community and to humanity. In addition, the governor is preparing a proclamation honoring Concordia and its centennial celebration. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today and ask you to join me in giving recognition to Concordia University on its 100th anniversary. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Questions, I stand to answer.
Thank you, Senator Carter. Any questions of the committee? I am just tickled that you've brought this resolution forward. There's nothing greater than honoring an institution that's been around 100 years.
That's
I would love to take a tour of the campus sometime.
I'll invite you. I'll invite the committee. I appreciate that.
Well, I love great architecture. And, you know, unfortunately in Eugene and urban renewal, they took out a lot of the old buildings. And so we don't have as rich of an architectural history as Portland does. I'm delighted, and this sounds like a wonderful school. If there are no other questions, Senator Starr, have you collected yourself to offer a motion for me here? I've just sort of forgotten over the weekend what the heck I'm doing.
So what happens when you go to Pendleton, Madam Chair?
It's what happens when I take three briefcases of work home. We're going to close the public hearing on SCR 4. We're going to open a work session, and Senator Starr is going to put me back on track.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendments to SCR 4.
Senator Starr moves the dash two amendments to SCR 4. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, Senator Starr.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move SCR 4 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves SCR 4 as amended to the floor of this glorious Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, that bill or that resolution is approved. And Senator Carter, would you like to carry it?
I would love to carry it, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Would you like us to, if you work with our committee administrator, she'll hold it as long as she can so that we can kind of coordinate it with your group coming?
Yes, we'd appreciate that, Madam Chair, so that the day that they're here, we're hearing it on the floor, and they'll get a chance to see how the Senate works in action. And I will be coming to all of you to seeing if you preserve that day to have some of them sit on the floor of the Senate with us as a means of them understanding more about the Senate and how it operates.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I think I closed the work session. If I didn't, we're doing it. Now we are going to get into something that I've been working on ever since I've been a legislator, and I'm so excited. But first of all, I want to welcome, I understand there's a lot of Oregon Education Association members out in the audience, and I just want to welcome you today. We enjoy having you here. We're not all so goofy, just me. So we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 748. And Marjorie, you want to talk about this bill a little bit?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 748 is a committee bill, and it directs the Department of Ed to prepare a financial education program and allow school districts to implement that financial education program. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. So, colleagues, let me just give you a little background. As you know, I'm a court reporter in bankruptcy court. I've been there 22 years now, and I see a lot of people coming in who can't pay their debts. I also see students in college and in high school who can't pay their debts, and I see basically that we have a society of financially illiterate people. You have at your desk an article that I copied out of the Register Guard in April of last year. There have been many such articles. I have a big file on financial literacy. And so I thought we needed to have a discussion about that. I introduced a bill last session, Senate Bill 827, that I'm hoping the university system will address. And we also have folks here from the bankers, the CPAs, and the credit unions, because lo and behold, they are all doing something wonderful about financial literacy.
When I went to high school, as a senior, we had a class that dealt with that. They no longer do that?
No, Senator Cruz, they do not. I think my son was one of the last classes in 96 that had a little two-week program on the computer to learn how to balance a checkbook.
Okay. Well, the class I had, it was called, different for different schools, called Modern Problems, and went into a whole lot of areas of living skills. So.
Well, we are going to hear from the Department of Education as to when and why they deleted that from the curriculum. So I encourage you to ask that question when he or she, it's a she, testifying. All right, we're going to start out with Pam Levitt from the credit unions. And Pam, I think you have three folks you want to bring up. And then we'll go to CPAs and then the bankers and then financial services.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. I'm Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 748. We are passing around our written testimony as well as a example curriculum, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. Madam Chair, you and I have been talking about financial education for several years, and it's nice to be here today. Credit unions in Oregon and throughout the nation have made financial education a top priority. We have focused on this issue at our conferences and events and have brought in speakers at state conventions and national conventions, and it's just been a top priority. There are many statistics that we can give you, and in our written testimony, you can read some of the facts, but recent studies have shown that the average American is only able to answer 45% of personal finance questions correctly. 4 out of 10 Americans admit they are living beyond their means, primarily because of the misuse of credit. Personal bankruptcy filings have doubled between 1990 and 2000. And according to 2002 Jumpstart Coalition Personal Finance Literacy Survey, high school seniors could only answer over 50% of questions correctly. Financial literacy is very important to you as a consumer. You need to understand financial education when you're buying a car, going to get mortgage, saving for retirement, buying cost-effective insurance, and creating your own family budget. The National Endowment for Financial Education has partnered with America's Credit Unions, and I've given you a model curriculum in your packets. You have the student handbook on the right-hand side, and that is also available in Spanish. And that is used throughout Oregon in classrooms. Currently, many of our credit unions are teaching that to students. In fact, I have heard that over 2,400 students were taught using the NEFI, National Endowment for Financial Education programs, just last year.
2,400 in Oregon?
Yes, 2,400 in Oregon.
Great.
Senate Bill 748 does a few things, but what it does not do, it does require the state to have a model curriculum and encourages the schools to use that model curriculum, but what it does not do is it does not require a separate class for financial literacy. It does not require the use of the model curriculum developed by the state, and it does not require the teaching of financial literacy at any specific grade level. Our credit unions in Oregon who are working in the schools do see the requirements, the mandates that schools have. We truly believe that financial education needs to be an important part of the curriculum, and we leave that up to you to decide how to work that in. But I did bring three experts who are in the schools working with students, and they have some compelling stories to tell you, and we'll start out with Carrie.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Davis. I'm the Special Services Manager at Rogue Federal Credit Union, located in Medford, Oregon. And Special Services Manager is a nice word for collection manager. So about 5 or 6 years ago, seeing the rise in bankruptcy, consumer debt, we started taking a real closer look, and we started counseling a lot younger membership. Right now, we have young people that are getting into credit card debt. We have some issues with some predatory lenders, such as check cashing places, title loan places, payday loans. And what's happening is because we have such a variety of products and services and the way that our financial world is, it has changed. It's gotten more complicated. Not only with the delivery, but regulations, the internet, internet banking, bill pay, a lot of different things have changed over the years. What has happened is our young people are drowning in this debt. They're getting credit card offers at very young ages. I've got kids that are getting into car loans at 26%, and they don't realize that that's a bad interest rate. We have kids that are being approached by their so-called friends, asking them to cash checks. And then those checks come back stolen or account closed, and the student is left holding the bag. They don't realize that by doing that and transacting it through their account that they're responsible. These kids are getting into, I have kids that I'm counseling on a regular basis that have already $3,000 and $4,000 in credit card debt. They're not out of high school. We've got kids that are sinking basically with their student loans. They're graduating from college that have more credit card debt than they do student loan debt. So part of what is happening is they don't have those skills and they're not getting it. What we try to do at Rogue Federal is try to go in and make some differences, or we hope are differences, and I'm seeing it turn around. We started with some community seminars initially, also putting in some bilingual Hispanic seminars on a variety of subjects that were open to the community as a whole. You didn't have to be a member. You could just come. They're free. But we started getting into the high schools and started teaching these kids, and we developed programs for these kids, and we go in and teach them about how to balance a checkbook, what to do with electronic services, credit reports, Auto 101, identity theft. The biggest growing group of victims right now is 18 to 25 in identity theft. That's because the kids don't know when not to give their information out. We live in a society that we feel like it's okay to give information out, and now we've turned it around, and these kids aren't getting it. I can go through the parking lot at South Medford High School and see their driver's licenses laying on the seat of their cars. They're just not getting it. So part of what we started doing is getting into the mainstream high schools. But there's some other areas that we need to address as well. That's our at-risk kids. I go into community works. These are kids that are homeless, that are going to school, working a job. They're trying to make ends meet. They might have kids of their own. And these kids desperately need living skills. This is everyday living skills, how to get that paycheck and what you do with it. So we're reaching the at-risk kids, community works, crossroads, opportunity high schools, teen parent programs. The need is so great out there that it's hard to get to everybody. But the credit unions are committed to providing that information and working with the teachers. We're willing to go in and help. Part of what we do is order the NEFI workbooks and get them into the schools and help them deliver that message. So from a collection manager point of view, if we can fix it on the front end, it'll save us a whole lot of heartache on the back end and keep these people from just drowning and make them financially secure. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony, Ms. Davis. You have experience with bankruptcy issues as a collection manager. And I also know that the credit unions, in response to the high number of payday lenders and title loan lenders, that the credit union has developed a program, a payday loan program that doesn't soak people for the kind of money that these other folks do.
We have developed those programs, and we're involved in that. But at the same time, what we try to do is when people come in for those payday loans, even at the credit unions, we're trying to educate them. Like, you know, you could have a line of credit, you know, with a credit union that at a much lower interest rate, and try to educate them. What is the ramifications? What's your needs right now? A lot of what we've gotten away from is the savings piece. People haven't saved, and so they want that short-term fix or that credit card fix to get them through the tough times. So part of it is getting that word out is you need to save for those emergencies. You wouldn't be here looking for that if we could have some of that back. So part of what we try to do is the education piece, even with that situation.
And that's the critical piece.
It's very critical.
All right, thank you. You are next, ma'am.
Yes. Hello, my name is Claudine Oriani, and I'm the Director of Community Education with OSU Federal. So, Madam Chair and Senate committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today on financial literacy, or unfortunately, as I'm finding out in the field, financial illiteracy. Like Carrie, our credit union is committing a considerable amount of time and human resources to go out there and provide financial literacy with high schools, middle schools, and even K through 5 education, where the teacher chooses to be creative, maybe look at their curriculum and bring us in where it makes sense, but they're having to really step out of the box to look at opportunities and create special opportunities. When that is the case, we have the pleasure of going in and working with young people. We do an assessment, first of all, to determine what level of awareness they have, and unfortunately, it's non-existing. Many of the high school people that I work with, young students that I work with, think that a checking account is a great investment tool. And so knowing where we're starting from, we then build upon that with a four-tiered approach. We deal with creating the saving habit earlier than later. There's a graph actually available in the workbook shared with you today, the NEFI workbook, that I don't share with adults because it gets them very depressed. Mm-hmm. And that is the value of time.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And not the amount, but how long you keep the money. That is so impactful. So we start with the saving habit, and quite frankly, if one student learns from one of our presentations the value, it's not how much you have, it's how long you keep it for, then I've earned my keep for the day. Second, depending on their age, then we also address checking account management, because that in and of itself creates its own history. And positively managing a checking account is a crucial life skill that these young people need to go out with. We also very much address credit management and how to use it as a tool to create a positive credit score, which is impactful in the area of insurance premiums, employment, the ability to rent an apartment or home, as well as future access to better rates on car loans and home loans. So deeply embed that to the small group that we're able to work with, and then beyond that, long-term investment. What does it mean to take that beginning saving account that you started at the age of 12 and realize early retirement at 50 rather than learning to say, would you like to biggie size that at 68? So we map that out for them. And clearly, my credit union alone, serving four counties, have been successful in the last school year in reaching over 1,200 kids between last year's accomplishments and this year's early accomplishments. But that's just scratching the surface when it comes to high school financial literacy, if indeed we were to focus strictly on that group. Now, working with schools, I've come to find out that I believe the statistic is 34% of our high school students choose to go on to acquire either an associate's degree or greater. That means that clearly a large portion of our young adults graduating from high school have no life skills as it pertains to money management, and no resources to gain it through community college or through university. And it's our passion for service, people helping people, which is the credit union motto, as well as the need that we see out there that has us out there. We are the conduit through which financial literacy takes place, both as subject matter experts, as well as providing the no-cost materials that you've seen as just one example, if the teacher prefers to present it themselves. But again, that's only scratching the surface, and what we ask for you is that you consider the potential for making this something that supports teachers, more teachers, bringing us into the classroom or materials into the classroom to ensure that 12th graders walk away with a good understanding of how to manage one of the critical resources in their lives.
So, Ms. Oriani, am I to understand that you're available, your credit union folks are available to go into the classroom at no charge and deliver this instruction?
No charge is the operative term, and it is my full-time endeavor to either develop and or render financial literacy to adult populations as well as young populations. In addition to that, my credit union has two regional managers whose part-time endeavor is to go out and do the same thing I'm doing. Therefore, we are putting forward not only the human resources, but the curriculum resources if need be. And I have a file probably 2 feet deep in just a list of resources beyond what you have available to you here, depending on the age, the delivery channel, and what the measurables are. So they're out there.
And then we're going to hear from the CPAs and the bankers, and they have programs too.
Absolutely.
So we're not at a shortage of people who have knowledge about how to teach financial literacy.
I'm hearing it's because of the way curriculum in the high school is structured. If it exists, it exists under an elective. And a young person not having a great deal of hope for continuing education is probably not going to elect for economy or any business. Yeah.
I mean, art, financial literacy, music, mm-hmm. financial literacy.
Exactly.
That'd be an easy choice for most people, so
right.
It shouldn't be an elective. Mm-hmm. Are any other questions of the committee? Cool.
Thank you.
Well, and I think, did you have a fourth person?
Yes.
You stepped in there. Great.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Corey Frondiner, and I'm the Director of Education Partnerships with MAPS Credit Union in Salem, Oregon. Like my colleagues, we have a program that takes financial education into the high schools and is now reaching down into the middle and elementary school levels. And I would like to share with you today a little bit of that example of how we have taken this project and hopefully are helping our young people be more financially literate. In 1994, MAPS Credit Union started a partnership with the Salem-Keizer School District, and at that time, sophomore economics was part of the curriculum and graduation requirement. We started this program with an idea centered on having an in-school credit union where the students would have an enhanced learning experience on two levels. The first level was to help them become wise consumers, and that has been maintained as our main focus. A second part of this program was to help the students that were working towards the Certificate of Advanced Mastery in the business CAM strand have an opportunity to be involved in a business in the school. The students who run this are the upper advanced level students who have to come in and go through the entire real world process of being interviewed. They have to go through the application process. We have very strict qualifications, and they go through an HR process. And then they are trained initially by MAPS personnel. Over the years, it's become where the students are now state training the students. During the hours of operation, the branch is used as a learning lab, which is attached to the business and management curriculum of the school. They have days where the branches are open and they're doing actual live transactions that are happening on accounts just like they would at any other branch. On the days that the branch is not open, they're covering things like operational techniques, confidentiality, business ethics, professionalism, and marketing. They're getting a real-world experience mirrored in the classroom. One of the features that's very important for this program that we find increasingly over the years is that we have many students in our school system now that don't have an opportunity to work outside of the home or the school environment to get school-to-work experience. By having the opportunity to work in this branch during actual school hours, it allows them to put on their resume that they have had school-to-work experience without asking for transportation or, in some cases, having families that do not feel that this is appropriate for their children to have an after-school job. We try to reach out to the diversity in our community also. One of the things that we have found is that many of our students wanted a more advanced and in-depth training than they could get actually in the branches. This developed into an intern program that's being done in the branches that we have in the Salem area. Students can go in on the weekends, Saturdays, and vacations and get more in-depth training, with a caveat that they take this knowledge back to our branches and share that with their peers in the classroom and help them learn more about the financial industry also. They become the supervisors and the trainers within the branch. Since we started our program in 94 in North Salem High School, we've opened a branch at McKay High School in 1997 and at West Salem High School in 2001. The classes are the business and management class that have evolved into the capstone class of the business and management academies. And these students are top-level students who look out and see a need. And one of the needs that they have seen is that financial literacy needs to start before they get into high school. These students have created, written, developed, and presented their own programs in financial literacy in the middle school and at the elementary school level. And I will share with you that we have great success in teaching kids about savings using Tootsie Rolls. They don't necessarily understand the dollars and cents, but they understand if they're given 5 Tootsie Rolls at the beginning of class and they don't have any at the end of class, they don't have any savings. So they use that as a real fun tool. But what happens is these students start seeing through this interaction, through their adult that's a high school person, wonderful information that they want to take home and they want to start savings. We are finding this has been a very successful program. The middle school students have a little more advanced. We do use more of the budget plan, more of the idea of what you can get if you save a few dollars a month starting at 10, 12, 14, where you'll be by the time you're retiring. So those programs have been very successful. One of the issues that we found that have evolved also is that we have a lot of students in our schools that come from multi-generational, multicultural, diverse families. Students that are in our high schools may be the only English-speaking person in that family. They are taking the tools that they get from these programs, take them home, and they're the ones that are responsible for helping their parents, grandparents, siblings, and extended family know how to handle their financial matters that come up with their families. The program that we had started as a way to help people learn how to handle finances, take care of their checking account, start a savings program, learn how to budget. What we're finding is that it's advanced to where our peers are teaching peers about how to protect themselves, how to protect their assets. We're dealing with the whole issue of fraud, identity theft, protecting themselves against that. The peer-to-peer training in the high school is much more powerful than just the adult going in there and telling them. They do listen. We support this bill as a way to give our students another opportunity to learn how to protect themselves, how to protect their assets, and grow into responsible citizens. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come here and share what we see as a very important issue with you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I really enjoyed hearing about what you're doing here in Salem.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any questions from the committee? All right. Well, thank you, all of you, for coming today. We're going to hear next from, is Rob coming up? Yes, he is. Mike Lewis and Rob Douglas, are you going to come up with Mike? Or are you going to let Mike do it on his own?
Help Joan come up.
Come on, Joan. Now they're going to leave you all alone, Mike, but I know you can handle it.
Thank you, Chair Walker.
Thank you. Introduce yourself for the rest of the committee because I already know you. You're a great guy from my community.
Chair Walker, committee members, thank you for having me here to provide testimony on the Senate bill. My name is Michael Lewis. I'm a CPA in Eugene, Oregon, and I have been involved in the Oregon Society of CPAs over the years, many years. Actually, I've served as a president of that organization at one time, and I've been involved in our national association, American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, and I mention that for a reason that I'll get into in a minute. Currently, I'm involved in a financial literacy, what we call strategic interest team, which is a committee dealing with the very topic that I'm here to talk about today. Similar to the credit union, we have statistics that mirror what they said just a few minutes ago. Our American Institute of Certified Public Accountants sponsored a survey with various state societies and found very similar results. They found that about 43% of the American public spend more money than they make. I think in our written testimony we say that they spend $1.22 for every dollar they make, and that's pretty scary statistics in my opinion. Also, we found through that survey that approximately the average household in the United States has $8,000 of credit card debt, and that's pretty scary to me. And I think about that personally, and I know in any one given week I probably get three or four applications in the mail for credit cards at my home, and three or four applications for credit cards at my office that I toss. You know, but it's so easy to get credit today. It's really scary. Also, we found in that survey that college students, once they leave college, are straddled with about $20,000 of student loan, mm-hmm. student loans and credit card debt, and that's a pretty phenomenal amount. Because of statistics like this, the AICPA, the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, they actually began a program and embraced a program called 360 Degree of Financial Literacy, and they have got the state societies throughout the country involved in this program. They have what we call an ambassador program where they're actually trying to train people through all the states to help sponsor this type of activity. The Oregon Society of CPAs has embraced this program, and thus we have the Financial Literacy Committee. We currently have three programs. We've met several times. We have three programs that we've started. One is a pilot program with the Oregon Food Bank. That program has been very successful in Portland. We've met with those people. There are they have their own material that we've been able to use in that program. We have had several volunteers step forward. It was an interesting process. It was one where when we met with them initially, they were just kind of touchy-feely to see how they would like the program. When we got involved in it, they've embraced it so much they want us to continue the program. It's one where we deal with, in many cases, single women with children, and they have to deal with their finances. And I believe the way we've approached it is when our volunteers go out, they say, here's an envelope for saving, here's an envelope for rent, here's an envelope for groceries. And it's really simple, but it really gets the point home to these people, and it helps them with their future. The other program that we started was one with universities. We actually, with their career development program, Pacific University, taught a class trying to help and assist the students there with their how they're going to handle their student loan responsibilities once they graduate from school. And I think that's been very successful. That program is going to be a continuing program as well. The third program we're embarking on is working with senior citizens. I think as senior citizens have difficulty sometimes, particularly both spouses, understanding what their responsibilities are, where their assets are held, the risk that they have perhaps in people trying to get them to invest their money in investments they shouldn't be investing in, those type of issues. So we are in process of working in that program. Plus, we are looking at several other opportunities throughout the state as to how we can assist people in increasing their knowledge of financial literacy. We talked about financial literacy, so I had to put a definition and be an accountant as to what financial literacy is. Financial literacy is defined as the ability to effectively evaluate and manage one's finances in order to make prudent decisions towards life, toward reaching life goals and achieve financial well-being. And I think the question that comes to my mind is, what is the real cost of financial illiteracy? We talk about the cost of debt, and you know, I look at what's going to happen in the future when we have more and more people reaching a threshold of illiteracy. What does that mean for us as taxpayers? What does it mean for government economies, for example? And it could have, I think, a very far-reaching and devastating effect for every one of us. We found that people do not always understand what the difference is between spending and debt, saving and investing. We heard that from the credit union people. Risk management, there's an awful lot of opportunity out there for making wrong decisions as far as risk goes. Planning for life's milestones, for example, buying their first home. Many people, if they do not get some kind of training, may never realize a dream of owning their own home, and we would not like to see that happen. It was interesting to me, last week I was watching PBC, of all things, and Susie Orman was on the show. And Susie's a pretty dramatic person, and I kind of like watching her sometimes and listening to her financial strategies. And she made a very profound statement while I was watching the show. She said, you know, what's happening with our children and financial illiteracy is they are coming, they're hearing in the media that there isn't going to be Social Security for them. There isn't going to be any money for them in the future. The national debt is getting out of control. There's not going to be any future for them. So their attitude, what's happening, is, according to Susie, is their attitude is one where they're saying, spend it now. Without any training, they're thinking, it's not going to be there tomorrow, so we might as well spend the money today and enjoy it. And that's a terrible thought, actually, I think. And she was actually promoting financial literacy on PBC, so we have support from many different sources when you don't when you listen, I think. I think we have a real obligation for our children to help them develop their financial responsibilities. And one of the things I have found on this committee, and like I said, it's just actually started, we've only had a few meetings and we've had great success, is that we have asked for volunteers to help us with this cause. And in the past, when I asked for volunteers for various committees or interested, yeah, I haven't seen the enthusiasm that I have seen for this. I know what we have seen is that we have more volunteers for this program than I have ever seen before. We have people that have been very active in the past, perhaps because of other commitments, gone away from volunteering their time for projects that we've had with the Oregon Society of CPAs. And now all of a sudden we have people wanting to be on the strategic interest team for financial literacy, wanting to help educate people with our programs that go forward. And that makes it a really exciting program. It also shows us that there's us CPAs are recognizing a real need out there in the community, that we're willing to step up to the plate because it affects all of us. So on behalf of our members, and we have 4,600 members throughout the state, or the Oregon Society of CPAs, we would urge you to support Senate Bill 748 to help improve financial literacy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a couple questions.
Certainly.
Have you been following the bankruptcy legislation that Congress is whipping out?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, I'll fill you in on just a little bit. It's something my judges haven't wanted to see come out, and it's mm-hmm. been stalled for about 7 years, and it looks like now the president will sign it, and the Senate just passed it out. It'll go to conference committee, but it's coming out, and it doesn't address credit cards at all. This is basically a credit card company bill because they don't like getting stiff.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like people filing bankruptcy on credit card debt, yet there was nothing in the legislation that prohibits them from constantly sending out these credit card advertisements in your mail, at your workplace that you're talking about. They even send them to children. And so I appreciate you talking about that. And it, you know, I finally got off the list by sending in my name to that company where you can get your name off the junk list.
Mm-hmm.
But do you see that with clients coming in and with
a lot of credit card debt? It's amazing to me the type of people that have debt that shouldn't have. People that have good jobs, for example. I think it's you get lured into the attractiveness of the idea that it's free money. I think if you read some of the literature, people think of credit card opportunities as free money. You know, they don't think about, as mentioned earlier, about the time value of money. The fact that you have to pay that credit card debt off, and it's got to come from your current income. So it's it is a real issue, and it's on all different income levels. It's not just at one income level versus another income level. It's very sad sometimes, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I hate to admit this, but I've been working on payday loan issues ever since I've been in the legislature also, and they have shown in the studies that it's not just low-income people who use payday lenders. It is regular folks, just people who are moderate income, high income. It's all over the map, but it's frightening. And you're right, when my daughter was real young, she said, Mommy, can you buy this for me today? And I said, no, I don't have any money. And she said, well, just take that card and put it in the machine in the wall.
Exactly.
at the ATM machine. I'm like, no, the money's not in the account, so I can't pull it out of the wall, out of that little machine. But for many kids, they don't see that. They just see that you can just give them your card and it'll go on your credit. The other thing you mentioned, Mr. Lewis, is college loans and debt. And I'm sure you see that in your practice as well. And we're going to have the university system talk about that. That's another one of my areas of concern, is that these kids are going into the university system or the community college system, and they're not getting academic advising to get them on the right track.
That's right.
And then they end up spending 5 or 6 years in school, and they just keep racking up the debt without any knowledge about where they're at on the grand scheme of being able to pay it back.
Exactly.
So we're going to hear from them about that. And then my last question was, you talked about the senior program that you had. Mm-hmm. How do you connect with the seniors? How do you get them involved in your program?
Well, we're going to go out to various senior centers and talk to them is our goal. I think that's in process. We haven't gone to our first one yet, but that's one we're going to be looking at.
Okay.
So it's a new process. But there are senior areas, retirement types of communities that we can go to and talk to the people and grow a program. One of the concerns I have there is sometimes it's just a risk issue, too, because they're going to hear a lot of hype that this investment is better than another one, and they can lose their life savings pretty quickly if they don't make wise decisions as to what they should be doing.
It's not just, well, comment, not just the credit card applications you get in the mail. It's also now the opportunities to borrow money you get in spam. So, and it's that is ramping up. I mean, my computer at home doesn't have spam blockers, and part of that's on purpose, so I can see what comes in, and it takes me a considerable amount of time to go through it all, but just in the last 6 months, the amount of borrowing opportunities over the internet has probably increased 1,000%.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, after I saw you after my class reunion this last summer and got excited about this program, I sent off a note to my classmate who's a CPA in Reedsport, and I do hope that he followed up. If he has not, you let me know.
Is that your 10th reunion?
Well, thank you, Senator Cruz. That would be nice if it was. Add another 10. All right. If there are no other questions, Mr. Lewis, thank you very much. We appreciate what the accountants are doing. I should call them CPAs, actually, certified public accountants. All right. Tim Martinez in the banker group. Come on up. Looks like we have
five. Oh, goodness.
Somebody has a PowerPoint or
something?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Martinez, and I believe this is the first time in 15 years I've ever appeared before an education committee. I'm not sure what that says about me, but it is indeed a pleasure to be before your committee today, Madam Chair. I'm joined today to my immediate right by Linda Navarro, who is the Chief Operating Officer for the Oregon Bankers Association. To her right is Deb Wilding, a Vice President with West Coast Bank, headquartered here in Salem, I believe, like Oswego nowadays, and Bernie Kronberger, Vice President, also OBA board member, and a Vice President at Wells Fargo Bank here in Oregon. The three of them are going to take you through some examples of what the association as well as individual banks are doing around the state. We are very supportive of your legislation. I note that there's not very many people testifying from either the OEA or other school groups, so I wish you luck, and we're here to help you on this bill.
We have someone from the Oregon Department of Education, and maybe one of the teachers in the room will get jazzed and come forward. Thank you, Mr. Martinez. Ms. Navarro, you're next. Would you want to state your name?
Yeah, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Linda Navarro, Vice President of the Oregon Bankers Association, and I'm pleased to be here today to talk to you a little bit about the important work that the OBA and our member banks do in the area of financial literacy. Our association has for decades, and actually this year marks our 100th anniversary, and for decades we've been involved in financial education efforts. I won't repeat the various statistics that you've heard today about the need for financial education in both the schools and in the adult population, but I would like to highlight for you a few things that our industry, few initiatives that we have in this area. You have, you should have in front of you a packet, it's purple, that has some information in it about some of OBA's programs and some of our member banks' programs. You're going to hear a little bit more detail about a couple of those great programs following my comments, but I will speak basically from the page you have titled OBA Financial Education Initiatives. I'll just highlight a couple of points that we made on that page. The first area is personal finance education in the schools, which we've heard quite a bit about today. That's been a very traditional way that banks have been involved in financial literacy in the past. We've been for years and actually have received national awards for our efforts in Oregon related to the PEP program, which is the personal finance program on a national level. That has basically included bankers volunteering in classrooms around the state to teach financial education. And those programs continue today. Some of our banks, like Cyrus Law Bank in Eugene, have actually been featured in national publications for their programs, which go year-round and use various curriculums that they've developed themselves and that are also available from sources like the American Bankers Association and the Federal Reserve Bank. In addition to that, we have a couple of days during the year that we really focus on. One of them is National Teach Children to Save Day. It happens to be coming up in April. Mm-hmm. And we promote that extensively. And that's geared toward the elementary school students. And what banks do there is they work with their local schools to come in and perhaps read a book, like a book called, there's a book called Lucky the Golden Goose, which is about the benefits of saving and the concept of compound interest. And it was actually written by an Oregon banker, but it's used all over the country on National Teach Children to Save Day. Oregon banks have participated extensively in that program, and in fact U.S. Bank in Oregon in recent years, they've educated more than 2,000 students on that one day alone in the elementary schools on the concept of savings. Another day that is singled out during the year on an annual basis is In Charge Day, which is basically a credit education day, and that one's geared more for the high school students. OBA has for years had a savings and financial education committee. Deb Wilding actually has served on that committee, and that committee's main purpose is getting all of our banks involved in these programs. And we put on forums on about an annual basis where bankers are invited and they hear from all kinds of guest speakers on financial education products and services and examples to motivate them to go out and take initiative and create programs in their communities or get involved in programs that currently exist. Beyond that, there are a number of programs that have endeavored to come into Oregon, like Operation Hope is a program that came into Oregon in 2003 in the Portland metro area, and the OBA and our member banks were very much involved in that initiative. I'll move on to talk about adult education because we also do a great deal and find a great deal of need in the adult population from the people who perhaps didn't receive the education that they may have needed and the life skills they may have needed when they were in school, or due to the changing marketplace need additional education. And our efforts there range from some minority outreach efforts through our community involvement committee, and Bernie Kronberger chairs that committee, and he'll probably talk about that, but most recently we sponsored some financial fairs for the Spanish-speaking community. We also are very involved in homebuyer education. For years, the Oregon Bankers Association took a lead in that, creating community committees, basically is what they were, of bankers and other members of the community that taught classes, and we developed a curriculum, and it was the best that there was at the time. But since then there have been organized efforts to create a more standardized curriculum in homebuyer education, and there's an organization called the Homeownership Education Collaborative of Oregon. I'm personally on the board of that organization, and our banks are active in supporting that organization financially and as volunteer trainers. The important point to us there is that program is actually statewide and delivers in all of the communities in Oregon. That it hasn't reached every community so far, but its goal is to reach communities all across the state. And that, of course, includes everything from savings to credit management to the responsibilities of home ownership. Beyond that, and I'm sorry, as an outgrowth of that, I'd just like to say that we've also developed a home purchase assistance program. It's been around since 1996, and the OBA and our banks fully fund the administrative costs of delivering that program, and it's helped hundreds of low-income families get into their first home with down payment assistance and closing cost assistance after completing, and one of the requirements is completing homebuyer education. Lastly, I would just like to touch on financial fraud awareness, because that has been a major important initiative of the association for several years. About 10 years ago, in fact, we started with our Elder Financial Abuse Prevention Project, and we've received a lot of attention for that project because we actually created kits in cooperation with the Senior and Disabled Services Division. I'm not sure if it's still called that, but the Department of Justice, the Area Agencies on Aging in Oregon, and the AARP, and together we created a kit that is a two-part training kit, and it is designed on one. The first part is designed to train bankers, frontline financial services personnel on how to detect and report to the proper authorities suspected fraud against elderly customers. But the second part is actually a consumer training kit. And this kit was given to every branch in the state of Oregon, as well as every banking association and every senior services division in the other 50 states. It's also been purchased even by some organizations outside the country. And the kit basically uses the example of Evergreen Federal Savings Bank, which created a unique training program for senior customers and community members to teach them about fraud and potential exploitation of their finances. And that's a very important program for us. You'll see in your packet, just last week we received a letter from the governor, and the governor has included us in his plans with his elder financial fraud task force to work going forward in expanding what we've done in the last 10 years to continue to educate consumers. And that, alongside with things like sponsoring public service announcements, which we've done at the association level on identity theft prevention in conjunction with the Fox affiliate news stations, are ways that we believe that consumers need to be continually educated on the risks of financial fraud that grow greater every day. Thank you.
Thank you. I was going to ask if you were working with the Department of Justice and the Attorney General's office, and have you prior to this time or just now going forward with the governor's task force?
Actually, no. For the last 10 years, it started 10 years ago. There was a piece of legislation that passed that allowed banks to report suspected abuse to authorities. And since that time, we've formed a joint work group that included us, the Department of Justice, and the Senior Services Division, and others. And that the outgrowth of that was the printing of this kit about 6 years ago. And in fact, the video that's part of this kit includes the Attorney General and the OBA President and others in the training program. So.
That's great. Thank you. Okay, Ms. Wilding, you're next.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Deb Wilding, and I manage the downtown branch of West Coast Bank. What I wanted to do today was just let you know a couple of things that our branch does in an effort to contribute towards financial literacy. We've established a partnership with Parrish Middle School, which is a lower-income inner-city school. And we established the program with Parrish to reinforce positive behaviors and to develop basic banking principles. We use Awesome Bucks, which are pseudo-dollars that the students earn through positive behaviors in the school, and then they deposit them into mock savings accounts that we hold at the school. We calculate interest for them and post it in their accounts every month, so they're learning to manage money, as well as their time and emotions, which we think is part of the middle school experience. Every Friday, we send employees to Parrish to take the deposits, and every 6 weeks, we have a shopping day so that students can choose to either spend their bucks or to save them, and they make the decision whether to gratify their immediate desires with a small ticket item or whether they want to save their money and buy a higher ticket item later on down during the school year, and we make that choice theirs. Because we've had the program for 6 years, our eighth graders are into their third year of savings, and I'm happy to say we've developed a lot of long-term savers with the kids in the middle school. The merchandise for the store is purchased through donations by the bank and other community partners of Parrish. And the other program that we've been working with is with another partner we have, Barbara Roberts Teen Parent Program. We developed a school-to-career training program with Barbara Roberts and made it specifically geared towards the teens. We wanted to try to help them transition from an academic setting into the workforce, and we structured the program to help them develop the standards and work ethics that employers are looking for. Some of the areas that we covered in this, besides making first impressions and preparing an effective resume, we also worked in planning a personal budget and investing for the future. once a training program was completed, a 90-day internship was offered to one of the students to provide on-the-job training and an opportunity to develop additional skills. And we actually hired a teller from that program when she was still a student at the school, and she's still working for us now. So these are just two of the opportunities we've taken to work our way into the school system. We've got 24 branches in our region, and they all have some type of program where they've worked with the schools in one way or another. And I wanted to let you know our president and CEO fully endorses our involvement in the schools. He not only provides us the resource to financially support the programs, but emphasizes the importance of the employees being active also. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Kronberger, before you start, I want to show you what I have. I have a letter that you sent me on April 8th, 2004, along with O Futuro Untos Manos, or Hands on Banking.
Correct.
And I still have that in my financial literacy file, and here you are in front of me. So thank you very much for coming and sharing with us today.
Thank you for the invitation, Madam Chair. And good afternoon, Madam Chair and fellow committee members. My name is Bernie Kronberger. I'm employed by Wells Fargo as its Community Relation Manager for the Oregon region. Also, I'm here today representing the Oregon Bankers Association, not only as one of its Board of Directors, but also as Chair of its Community Involvement Committee. My testimony today is intended to provide you with a better understanding of the educational outreach activities that are currently underway at Wells Fargo, which are intended to serve as a resource to address the lack of financial literacy in our educational system and marketplace. We feel this gap is a social and economic financial crisis. Also, I will highlight the OBA's outreach to nonprofit groups' involvement in financial education fairs targeted towards low to moderate income individuals and families throughout Oregon. We are all aware that financial education is not taught in schools today, and the results of this deficiency are all around us. A consumer culture, staggering levels of personal unsecured debt, a sad reliance on government assistance on the part of the poor and elderly, minuscule savings rates, and a shockingly high rate of personal bankruptcy. I'll share some of the statistics with you, which you've previously also heard of one, but I think we need to amplify those. Wells Fargo has a proud history of supporting communities where we live and work. Our success depends on the success of the communities we serve. We are committed to promoting economic development and self-sufficiency through financial education. Now I would like to introduce you to Hands on Banking and the Spanish language version El Futuro en Tus Manos. Developed by Wells Fargo as a free public service, our innovative program contains no commercial content or product content. This educational program is accessible via the internet at www.handsonbanking.org, via CD-ROM, which you have in your file, or hard copy. Why is hands-on banking important? Hands-on banking provides a quality program to address the critical need for money management skills training for youth and adults. Did you know, and this is based on 2003 stats, nearly 90% of high school students graduate without knowing the basics of banking, checking and savings accounts, budgeting, credit, and investing. Almost half of college students pay late fees on their credit cards, and 7% have their cards canceled due to late fees. The fastest growing group declaring bankruptcy is young adults aged 20 to 24. Last year in the U.S., 110,000 people under the age of 25 filed for bankruptcy due to their inability to pay on their credit card debts. And more startling is the fact that more people within this age group filed for bankruptcy than graduated from college.
Oh.
12 million U.S.
households. What age group was that, Mr. Kronberger?
Pardon me?
What age group was that?
110,000 people under the age of 25 filed for bankruptcy in 2003. And the fact is that more than 20, in this 20 to 25 age group, the people that filed for bankruptcy outnumber the people that graduated from college.
That's a startling statistic.
12 million U.S. households, fully one-fourth of all lower-income families, have no relationship with a bank, savings institution, credit union, or other mainstream financial service provider. One-third of new small businesses close in less than 2 years. About half close in less than 4 years. And the ever-increasing incident of financial abuse that we're witnessing. The key elements of hands-on banking include: it's a customized curriculum for high school age students, for all age students that meet or exceed national, as well as, I want to emphasize, state educational standards for math, literacy, and exercise. Lessons are narrated, animated, and colorful. Special features include an ATM simulator, calculators, and a dictionary of financial terms. Teacher's guides contains worksheets and assessments. Teachers can easily integrate hands-on banking into their lesson plans. The focus on the financial education for adults includes a resource library for in-depth instruction for money management, first-time home purchases, money smart tips for senior citizens, and tips for starting and managing a small business. Just to name a few examples of the educational institutions that have adopted our hands-on banking program, they are the Los Angeles Unified School District, which is the second largest school district in the U.S. Here in Oregon, the Oregon Council for Hispanic Advancement has endorsed and adopted this program for their educational curriculum. And schools such as Alder Elementary in the Park Rose School District and Lane Mills School in the Portland School District. Finally, the U.S. Government General Services Administration is using the Wells Fargo Hands-on Banking CD-ROM as a mail-out in response to consumer inquiries regarding money management matters. Regarding the OBA Community Involvement Committee, which provides a forum for member financial institutions where we share ideas and discuss issues related to community reinvestment activities and to advance the spirit of cooperation among all those interested in working toward community growth and development. Committee objectives include the sharing CRA service, investment, and lending opportunities among members. We work with concerned individuals, agencies, or groups referred to as community development partners. We facilitate communication between local communities and OBA members. We have a strong relation to low to moderate income individuals in geographic areas in the region. We increase the understanding of the Community Reinvestment Act, including regulations and examination procedures. In the last 2 to 3 years, we have held numerous financial education fairs in Medford, Woodburn, McMinnville, Salem, Portland, and Hood River. These are all geared towards the Hispanic community and low to moderate income individuals and communities. Almost everyone's financial picture varies at different stages of life, so it's never too early or too late to improve our money management knowledge and skills. Thus, I would submit to you that Wells Fargo's Hands-on Banking Financial Literacy Program provides money skills you need for life. Let me conclude my testimony today by stating that the goals of Wells Fargo's Financial Literacy Program is to provide a resource that educators and practitioners can use in showing our kids, their parents, and all Oregonians how to motivate and give license to dare to dream, to help understand the importance of checking savings accounts, budgeting, personal credit, investments, and other economic tools, to teach them to take responsibility for their lives, and to provide an aid in achieving economic literacy so they can function knowledgeably in today's and tomorrow's financial marketplace. As one fifth grade student told me after experiencing the hands-on banking program, and I quote, "Being financially literate will help me manage my bank accounts, will teach me how to invest my money, and will prevent anyone from financially taking advantage of me. Learning about financial literacy is as important to me as learning to read and write. Thank you for the privilege to appear before you today, and I hope I have increased your awareness about Wells Fargo's bilingual financial literacy program, Hands-on Banking, El Futuro en Tus Manos, and our efforts to address the financial education gaps that currently exist with our kids, their parents, and fellow Oregonians, and to review some of the OBA's community involvement activities around our state. Thank you for your attention. I'd be pleased to answer any questions you might have."
Well, thank you, Mr. Kronberger. Senator Morissette has a question.
Thank you. I'm wondering how many of those 25-year-olds who file for bankruptcy were college graduates.
I'm sorry, I don't have those statistics.
Is there any connection, do you suppose? High loan load for people who are graduating? It would be interesting to see the rate of college graduates
right.
who do file. So maybe it isn't just education. People find themselves maybe in a situation.
Right, because of the cost of education.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
And Senator Morissette, college students are not able to discharge their student loan debt very easily in bankruptcy court. You have to meet a hardship element, right. And it means that you can't work. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you can work at a Burger King, the government's coming at you with a bat, and they're going to crack your kneecaps. You're going to work at the Burger King, and you're going to pay back your student loan.
Thank you for that information.
Trust me, they are very strong about that. Senator Cruz, did you have a question?
Well, I was just going to say the interest rate on a student loan is certainly much more manageable than the interest rate on a credit card. Some credit cards are around 30%, which is just amazing that people would get trapped into that sort of thing. But I mean, you know, like for stores and different things like that.
Well, may I? Mm-hmm. Okay, I guess what I was saying is that I wasn't necessarily just talking about student loans. There are many people who enter college who have credit cards, who get other credit cards. And so the credit card phenomenon, and I know that you do outreach at student unions and some of those places to get to those college kids who are in that credit card, you know, dead end alley, in a sense. So that might be one of the contributing factors if indeed there are college students who file.
Yeah, but Senator, I think the main thing is that it requires financial awareness, and I think these types of programs that are available either through our financial institution or other resource providers, the key is knowledge and make it available at an early age, as well as you go all through life. So the key is providing resources to the public. And that's what our attempt is.
May I? Mm-hmm. I believe that you either had a bill or had some concern about educating new college students, incoming college students, to the credit card invitation that they receive when they enter college.
That's a good memory, Senator Morissette.
Well,
Senate Bill 827, and the university system is going to address that when they come up to chat with us. And that was before Senator Starr's Education Committee last session, and I withdrew the bill because the university system agreed to work to develop that program, and so we're going to see how successful they've been at that.
Okay.
But I really appreciate you coming. As I said, I had in my file from 2004 when you mailed the letter to me, and I read it and put it in my financial literacy file, and the file just got bigger and bigger, and I was so glad when Ms. Levitt came to me and said, can we introduce a bill? And I'm like, oh yeah, let's do it. So, and then I was having dinner with Mr. Martinez and told him we were going to do an education program on that, and he said, wow, well, let's bring the bankers in. And then I knew the CPAs were doing it. So this is really a wonderful education for us as legislators, and I appreciate the involvement that you put into the community and all the volunteer time.
Well, we thank you for your comments.
Thank you. Okay, well, we're going to hear next from Paul Cosgrove with Financial Services and Susie Irvine. I think Susie's the one that has the little laptop program there.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Paul Cosgrove. I represent the Oregon Financial Services Association. With me today is Susie Irvine, who is the president of the national affiliate AFSA Educational Foundation from Washington, D.C. You're getting two large packets of information, and I'll just briefly tell you what they are, and Susie's going to summarize what's in them. First, this booklet. This is the report of the Jumpstarts Coalition survey, national survey of the financial literacy of high school students. They've been doing that since 1997. The latest survey is in 2004. Ms. Irvine will summarize the results of that briefly for you, but this has all the questions and all the data of how our students are not terribly literate financially, unfortunately. In the packet, you'll also see a whole lot of pamphlets and a copy of Ms. Irvine's testimony, but I wanted to highlight two things for you. One is the AFSA Education Foundation just received a federal award for $200,000 from the U.S. Department of Education for its money skill curriculum. And in a moment, you'll hear about the curriculum, but more importantly, you'll get to actually see it on that screen. And this is the brochure within the packet that describes in more detail than we'll be able to get in today that curriculum. And you even have a little CD that Ms. Irvine will talk to you about how you can use to test the curriculum. The other materials in there are a number of other pieces of educational material that the foundation has directed at some at kids, some at adults. From this point forward, we'll concentrate solely on the educational programs that we direct at school kids, and in particular the money skill curriculum, because that's the subject matter of this bill. Mm-hmm. Just one summary comment before I turn it over to Susie. I think that the bill directs the Department of Education to provide an educational curriculum. I don't think there's any question in the minds of all of us in the room who've been working in this area that there are lots of curricula out there. It's a matter of finding the right ones and getting those information, that information to school districts to use it. So with that, I would turn it over to Susie Irvine, who's president of the AFSA Educational Foundation.
Thank you, Mr. Crossgrove.
Thank you for the opportunity to tell you about the American Financial Services Association's financial literacy programs. I consider our work with all ages from all walks of life to be very important. By teaching the basics and complexities of personal financial management, we empower people to make sound financial decisions and the power to remove themselves from the danger of falling into abusive or fraudulent situations. As president of the AFSA Education Foundation, this is at the forefront of my mind, and I might add that it has been for the past 20-some years. I've been a director of a consumer credit counseling service where I work directly with people experiencing financial problems, and also as a single parent with a grown son now, who I loaned my credit card to, and it was kind of a horror story that I won't go into in any great detail with you, but Mom asked for the card back. Our mission at the AFSA Education Foundation is to help consumers reap the benefits of responsible money management, understand the credit process, and seek help if problems occur. The foundation's activities are centered in four main areas. One, we run multimedia communications programs. Two, we foster and build financial literacy partnerships. Three, we are one of the founding members of the Jumpstart Coalition for Personal Financial Literacy, an organization that seeks to improve the financial literacy of young adults. And as Paul mentioned, we have provided for you today their latest survey that was done in 2004. And fourth, in support of Jumpstart's mission, the foundation launched Money Skill, which is a highly interactive online personal finance curriculum for high school students. This curriculum was developed by Dr. Louis Mandel, who is at the University at Buffalo and has been involved in finance his whole academic career. The need for Money Skill was identified after we saw the disturbing results of the four nationwide surveys conducted by Jumpstart. These surveys reveal consistently low scores on the basics of personal finance. In the most recent survey, only 6% received a C or better. Of the 4,000 students included in the study, 2/3 failed. Worse, the average score was 52, and this is a failing score. This research has established that our young adults do not possess the tools and knowledge of personal finances required to get started in life without financial mishap. Now add this to the dismal research results. The teen market has immense buying power. In 2003 alone, teenagers spent over $175 billion on products and services. And guess who financed most of this?
Mom and Dad.
Mom and Dad. 58% of it came from parents.
And their credit cards, most likely.
Now back to Money Skill. Money Skill's 34 modules cover the areas of income, expenses, assets, liabilities, and risk management. To evaluate effectiveness of both content and method of presentation, students are given pre- and post-tests and are evaluated by module test scores and course grades. Money Skill includes two real-life simulations which allow creation of a personal financial plan from the time a student is financially independent of parents to the intended age of retirement. This feature will ask a student, and in this case I'm going to say Paul, to envision what he expects to get out of life, such as what kind of job, what kind of neighborhood will he live in, what type of house does he want to buy and live in, and what kind of car will he be buying. The program takes the information that he keys in and calculates after-tax income and total expenses and shows whether or not Paul's plan is viable. It probably wasn't. If it's not, Paul's then sent to the crash and burn module to make repairs. We think Money Skill is ideal for high schools because it incorporates three specific features. First and foremost, it is free. Second, the teacher can go through the program as a student and learn where he or she is strong in the subject matter and where additional preparation might be needed. Third, Money Skill has a built-in gradebook that electronically records each student's module test scores and course grade. Several teacher training workshops involving hundreds of teachers are underway or planned. More than 800 teachers have gone through the training in New York, Wisconsin, West Virginia, Tennessee, Utah, and New Jersey. What we have learned is that the typical teacher can reach at least 100 students per year. That means that the more than 800 teachers trained could potentially reach 80,000 high school students in an academic year. Daily, I approve an average of 5 new teacher registrations. As of today, more than 1,500 teacher registrations have been approved from all 50 states and 12 foreign countries. From Oregon, I have received 18 teacher registrations, and as of last week, there were 133 students had enrolled in the course. I asked our computer technician to go in and give me some additional statistics. The students' average score on their pretest is 51. No post-test had been taken by the Oregon students who completed at least half of the curriculum. Their average overall score is 77, which that shows pretty good from the post of 51 that through the process of what they've gone through so far, there has been learning. What I'd like to do now is just go right to the demo, show you a little bit of the curriculum, and as soon as I figure out what I want to click on.
Ms.
Here.
Irvine, how long does that take?
Not long.
Okay.
I can do it.
We can get through Paul to crash and burn pretty quickly, right?
Right, very quickly. What we'll do is
Madam
I'll
Chair,
just show you.
To show my financial literacy, I thought I had counted the right number of packets for y'all, and I did not, and so I will be bringing more back to staff to reflect that I have already failed.
So he's already. Okay, we'll just go into income, and just to give you an idea. Also with this, there's audio. which is on mute for us right now, and I suppose I could unmute it. We didn't want it interrupting everyone else's.
Just how important earned income is to us, particularly when we are still young and haven't built up other sources of income. We also will learn how earned income is determined, which will help us decide what occupation we will choose, how much education we need for that type of job, and how much we are likely to be paid when we start our careers. We will also find out how our income is likely to relate to where we decide to live and whether we join a union. In Module 1 of the Income Unit, you will learn the following. Why people with more education tend to earn more money. How the demand for certain skills helps determine the amount you will be paid. Why a shortage of people with needed skills will push salaries up. Who joins unions and why? And how your pay relates to the state and region in which you live and the tax policies of the state.
Okay, once they completed going through the text, they click on the arrow and they'll go on to the next part.
For most of us, the standard of living that we will enjoy over our lifetime depends largely on the total income that we will earn. Income that we earn when someone pays us in the form of hourly wages, regular salaries, or tips is known as earned income. In 2001, earned income accounted for 62.1% of total income that people received. As we saw in the previous module, family income depends on both the number of family members who work and the amount of money that each is paid. Other sources of income.
What they would do, they would go through the text here. We're not going to read it. We won't listen to it. There's a quiz when they're finished in each section. And the question asks, what portion of total income earned by Americans is unearned or income other than earned income? A, more than half. B, between a quarter and a half. C, between a tenth and a quarter. D, less than a tenth. Okay, Paul.
Let's do more than half because I think it's wrong.
So which do you want? More than a half?
He wants A.
B.
Are we? Star wants B.
Okay. Either way, we're going to see what happens. Incorrect. Now, if there was audio, what it does, it tells them that it's incorrect, and then they explain the correct answer and why it is correct. And this is done on every question as they go through here.
You got that right.
Well, one thing, if I may interrupt just for just a second, that I think makes this very different than other curricula is kids are used to learning online, and this is a total online program. It's the only web-based curricula in this area. And once a teacher calls Susie to sign up, he or she gets their ID number. The whole program is then laid out for them. They can take as many modules as they want. They can do the pre-tests and the po-tests, and they get the grade book, and they can integrate it into other courses, which I think is a real advantage in this day and age. I'm sorry, I interrupted
that. Mr. Ryan, do they do this during the school day, or is this assignment that they do after school?
It can be done both ways. What we are finding, in some cases, it's done, and there are classrooms that have computers, or it's assigned, and they can go to the library, the computer lab, or it's done at home. It's various ways.
We do have a teacher sign up to testify today, and I think that teacher's probably going to tell me, how much more are you going to give me to teach these kids?
Right.
We're also going to get the history of why it was taken out of the curriculum in the first instance, but that can be assigned as homework.
Right.
And they can do that.
To me, I think it's ideal as extra credit for high school seniors, you know, to complete it. And I think what encourages completion is to make it a part of a grade of whatever course you're teaching, and in many cases we're finding it's like 20% of the overall course grade.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, I think I kind of summed this up quicker than I really intended to here, but I think that we feel that the high school graduate wins by going through this program because he can make wise financial choices. And these not only will benefit him immediately as he goes on to college or if he does not, but also will help him in his overall adult life. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions, Senator Morissette?
Yeah, what's the cost to the
student? No cost.
A phone call to a 1-800.
No, it's you do it online. You don't call
I'm
me.
Sorry.
Right. Everything's
email.
Online here.
Excuse me.
So, Senator Morissette, everything we've been told today is free.
Right.
There's nothing better than free.
That's right.
Other than more hours in a day. But did you have a question, Senator Starr? You get the gold star today because you got the question right.
Yes. No, this just points out that more and more of our education is going to be delivered online 24/7 at a computer terminal. And I'm mighty thankful to have this testimony to support my premise.
Well, I hope we don't lose real teachers.
I will never lose real teachers.
I think they're important.
Or the socialization that
Okay, great. Thank you both for coming. I appreciate it. And we do need to finish by 5 today because we have a second hearing beginning at 6. So we're going to hear from Elizabeth Bickford from the U of O and Kate Peterson from OSU. Beavers in the Duck.
Madam Chair, I'm through page 110 of this book and I've got it all right so far.
Oh. Are you looking for a gold star too, Senator?
No, I was just saying, but they're very good questions.
Good. I can't wait to read it. We're going to have fun. Okay, ladies. And then after you, we're going to hear from Andrea Morgan from the Department of Education and James Matisse, and we'll all have them come up at the same time, and they'll finish up. So take it away. You got about 10 minutes.
Thank you, Chair Walker and members of the committee, for this opportunity for us to share with you programs that have been in place.
Oh, maybe. Yes. State your name, please. I'm sorry.
Oh.
I know who you are.
Hi. My name is Elizabeth Bickford. I'm the Director of the Office of Student Financial Aid and Scholarships at the University of Oregon. And with me is Kate Peterson. She is the Director of Financial Aid and Scholarships at Oregon State University. And we will be providing updates on how our students are doing in managing their educational debt, areas that we have expanded or improved on, and many of these are issues that were raised during the discussion, I believe, last year in Senate Bill 827. There are several drivers that help us in on the campuses, in financial aid and in student affairs units, that guide us in what to teach and how to deliver the message. And one of the measures, or one of the drivers, is federal requirements. Certainly national research on loan indebtedness, credit card indebtedness, the expanded use of technology and how that can help us in teaching our students, which we've just seen a really good example of, and, of course, listening to our students as they tell us what is the best way to deliver the message to them. So our presentation, we will review these services and expanded services on our existing programs and areas where the financial institutions have been helping us out in this endeavor. You should have a handout from the Oregon University system, which is our written statement for the committee. What we want to first talk about is there isn't a one-size-fits-all approach for our different campuses. We really have to expand and be creative in how we address the freshmen in credit cards, seniors in credit cards, and other educational loan opportunities. And certainly our parents are a big part of our educational process. But we all have in common, all colleges and universities, in the federal requirements for the educational loan programs, and this is in entrance and exit counseling that we must offer in order to be in compliance. These entrance and exit counseling, they're sessions that provide opportunities for us to talk about budgeting, financial planning, rights and responsibilities from on the educational loan programs, repayment terms, loan consolidation, etc. Even as recently as 4 or 5 years ago, educational loans were really the first time a student really entered into a loan. Now, many of our students, this is the second relationship with borrowing money, the first being with credit cards. So we realize that the type of information that we need to teach them might be just a lot different than where we were 4 or 5 years ago. These sessions are conducted in group sessions and in one-on-one counseling. And the group sessions tend to be 30 to 40 people and possibly even more, which actually we think causes students to tune out and not really listen to us. So one of the expanded areas really is in online entrance counseling. And this is what we call studying and testing. And in order to satisfy this federal requirement, before students can receive loan proceeds, they have to go through an entrance counseling. And they can do this 24/7. They study the material. It's an interactive session, and they must pass a test or they don't satisfy the requirement. So this allows students to not waste an hour with the financial aid office the first week of the term. They can actually go online at their convenience, and we think they're actually learning something from the online site. And, of course, we have the exit counseling, which we at that point can provide to them up-to-date information regarding loan repayment programs and loan consolidation. And between the entrance and exits, what the financial aid office can provide is counseling whenever the student comes in to talk with us about financial problems. Maybe they're in a financial crisis, but we have some expanded opportunities because of information provided within the federal government online ability to look at total aggregate dollars that the student has borrowed to date. We can take this information and actually go on to online calculators, and they can see for themselves, based on what they've borrowed to date, what that means in terms of a loan repayment. And not only does the financial aid office have access to this, but students and parents also have access. So there's a lot more information at the fingertips of the students. And this is, I think, a very important part to managing financial debt for students in the education environment. This is also an opportunity when they're sitting down with us to talk about credit card debts and other consumer debts that the student may be racking up. And it's an opportunity for us to get in and ask them about how they're managing, how much money do they have coming in, how much money have they targeted to go out. And it's, again, one of these opportunities that they can learn from us and we can learn from them about where they're at.
Ms. Bickford, can I interrupt you for a moment? How many students avail themselves of that opportunity?
To come in?
To come in and get that individual counseling instead of doing the entrance-exit. How many come in between to talk to you where you have been that opportunity to address other financial issues in their life?
We probably see over the course of the year about 2,000 students out of a population where we have about 10,000 students on federal aid.
Okay.
So a number of the students are not running into a financial crisis where they actually come in and want to rearrange their financial aid package. And I'm not sure about the other institutions, but I'd say that's probably a reasonable underestimate at this point.
Okay, great, thank you.
And so we have the ability to kind of get to the students at the beginning, get to the students at the end, and in the middle. And the reason why we are looking at the credit card issue along with education issue is when students go into repayment, we want to make sure that students are able to pay the loans off. And the way that we look at how our students are doing in repayment of the loans is looking at our default rates. And in last September, when the federal government released the federal default rate, which is at a 5.2, the Oregon University system had as an average a 3.3 default rate. And if we look at the what we believe will happen in this next September, it will also fall. So we are doing better than the national average in the state of Oregon, the state has a 4-point default rate, and we're doing better than the state average. So we believe that we're actually getting the right information out to help students make good decisions about the loan indebtedness. Of course, we wish there were other forms of financial aid available so that we weren't trying to help students manage debt when they graduate and go into repayment. Also, some good news. Nellie Mae, which is a large lender in the nation, conducted a report on undergraduate credit card indebtedness and some of the usage and trends with undergraduates. And what their report indicates that since the year 2000, there's actually a 15% decrease in the average indebtedness of college students who are going to college and have credit cards, and that there is a slight decrease in what they call excessive borrowing, which is identified as 7,000 or more. Now, the downside to that is in the 3,000 to 7,000, that percentage has grown. But they believe that some of the information, in fact, Nellie Mae credits the information that we're getting out to the campuses in a variety of ways and in different venues, has really helped students understand about credit card indebtedness, and also the availability of the public understanding about what they call the dangers of getting deeply in debt. We still have a lot of work to do in the financial aid offices in this area, but we believe we have a really good start at this point. And we certainly appreciate the leadership from Madam Chair and the committee as they continue to help supporting us in this effort. I would like to turn the presentation now over to Kate, who will give us more information about the campus-wide programs offered through the Oregon University system that are not part of the financial aid office.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Kate Peterson, the Director of Financial Aid and Scholarships at Oregon State University. And on most campuses, OUS campuses, providing services regarding student debt and credit card management is a shared responsibility amongst a number of different departments or units. Typically, it's shared between the Office of Financial Aid, Business Affairs, the Orientation Office, and Career Services, and in two instances, the Academic Success Centers. Over the past year, the availability of these services has expanded with a recent focus on credit card debt and private or signature loans. And gathered information from most of the OUS institutions, and what I have for you is a summary of the most common services that are being provided currently. Orientation sessions are held throughout the spring and summer for prospective students and their parents. And among the services provided are workshops for students and parents together, and then separate workshops just for the parents talking about how to pay for college. And information that is pertinent to the students being successful in managing their own personal finances, many times for the first time in their lives, is covered. And then with the parents in their separate workshops, they talk about the billing process, how to view or share information on the student's account, payment options, what types of financial aid are available and how to receive that financial aid, what types of charges financial aid can cover, employment opportunities on campus or in the local communities, the pros and cons of credit cards and debit cards, and then the uses of the student identification card. In addition, there are fall courses that are offered to new students. Continuing students may also take these classes, but they are designed for new students. And it, again, is designed to assist students in making a successful transition into college. So they teach study skills and a number of other things. But they also include one or two sessions on how to manage your personal finances. These are sometimes co-taught with lenders that partner with the institutions. So they bring in experts to help talk about banking, credit cards, online student services that allow students to monitor their student account at the university, to make payments on their account, to also monitor their financial aid status, account balances for meal cards. There's also information on the availability of institutional loans, the need to reapply for financial aid annually, student employment opportunities, and career services. There's also an expansion of correspondence, and as Elizabeth had mentioned, we're learning that there's a difference in how you correspond with parents and how you correspond with the students. So correspondence is many times in written format that goes out to the parents and is more likely email and website links for the students. We have advising on students on loan consolidation that goes out in email a couple times per year, and then hard copy information that goes out to the parents with the intent to provide good consumer information, allow students to make good decisions on whether or not they should consolidate their student loans and how to make that decision. We also have web links that allow students to create personal budgets. They include loan repayment calculators and provide information on what is the manageable debt load in terms of student loans compared to their annual income. Career Services has information available on the average starting salaries for their career choice. There's also direct links to the National Student Loan Data System, which is a national database that has all the individual student loan portfolio information. Students can access that, and it also provides them with direct links for customer service at the national level, whether it's FFELP loans to the lenders or through banks, or whether it's the direct loan through the Department of Education. Also, financial aid and business office personnel have begun to train other staff and faculty on campus to help students that they meet with to provide basic information on money management, but more importantly, to refer students to the services that are available, whether they're on campus or off. Thank you.
Wow. You guys have done a lot. And it's come a long way since 2003. I'm impressed. Any questions? Okay, well, I thank you for your testimony. Well,
thank you. Thank you for your leadership in this area, as I said.
You're welcome, and I am really grateful that you've taken your leadership role also with university students. It's really important. Okay, thank you, ladies. We're going to back clean up. We've got 10 minutes left, so 5 minutes apiece. Andrea Morgan with the Department of Ed and James Matisse, who's been sitting patiently in the front row. So we'll start out with the Department of Ed, and then James, you'll take us home. How's
sure,
that?
I can do that. Thank you.
Chair Walker and committee, thank you for letting me have this opportunity today. For the record, I'm Andrea Morgan. I'm the curriculum specialist for social sciences for the Oregon Department of Education. And I'm here today to give you just a summary of what's going on currently, because we've heard a lot about that personal finance is gone, that it's no longer there. But I want to let you know that it is very much a part of the Oregon social sciences standards. While the law changed and social sciences is no longer a part of the Certificate of Initial Mastery, it's a subject area endorsement, the law still states that we should be instructing to the state standards, and the standards do definitely include personal finance standards. In fact, it says we should have instruction in civics, history, geography, and economics, including personal finance. It makes it very, very, very clear. In 1997, the half unit credit was taken out of the requirements for personal finance. However, that curriculum was placed then within economics. And I think a lot of the reason it was removed in 1997 had to do with the situation with licensure. Any teacher, any licensed teacher could teach personal finance. And sadly, it became a place where either the instruction was wonderful or the instruction was, shall we just say, less than wonderful, because it became a place where people who needed an extra period to fill their schedule, since you didn't have to have a particular license, you taught personal finance. And so now I think we actually have something a little better in that we now have what we want students to know and be able to do, instead of just simply saying that there's a course that should happen without those specifications. And so within the standards, you'll see that we have benchmarks and eligible content that range from elementary level into the high school level, that we don't expect the instruction to only be at the high school level. It's still, I think, an important part. We've heard it today, and I will amplify that as well, that it's important instruction, and that's why it's part of the Oregon standards. Oregon is one of the few states that actually has it as part of their standards as mandated instruction. And so while I'm sure that we have a ways to go to making everyone financially literate, at least we have the groundwork in Oregon to have a much more successful program. And so with that, if you have questions, you'll notice that I gave you a handout that explains the history of this, but I wanted to point out to you on the end there are challenges to this as well, and simply that we have 3 units at the high school level now required, where before we had 3.5. We now have the requirements of No Child Left Behind. Social sciences are not a required part for assessment under No Child Left Behind, nor is it now required for the Certificate of Initial Mastery. So that has become a challenge. And it becomes a question in those 3 units, what do we give up or how do we do this? Because I know that for some here, civics education is important, and we would hate to see that go away. All of this is important in the social sciences, and so again, it's a matter of how do you balance it and make sure that all of these areas are represented. But I'm proud of the fact that Oregon has this as a required part. Our content and assessment panel and the panels that worked on the standards revision in 2001 made sure that it continued to be included. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I do, Ms. Morgan. If it's part of the curriculum, why aren't we seeing it? Why aren't we seeing it in our schools? I know that Sheldon High School doesn't have it anymore. At least they got rid of it. Whether they brought it back since my kids graduated, I don't know.
Chair Walker, I think what the answer to that is that it's been included in economics classes, or a lot of schools have also begun to look at other places to put this instruction versus in a social studies class. I know of a couple school districts where it's become part of almost a personal wellness course, and so it's actually been put in with their health curriculum in some ways, with the idea of this whole personal wellness, you know, living well financially as well as having a healthy life. And so by having it as part of the standards, it doesn't necessarily have to be in a course called personal finance, but there might be a number of places where these standards are addressed.
Okay. Second question is, what is your position on the bill, and how much would it cost the Department of Education to have to get this going? Because it sounds to me like you have something going already.
Chair Walker, at this point, we'd have to say we are neutral to oppose, simply because we do have all of this available. It would be quite expensive for us to take that robust list of curriculums that you saw today and to make sure that they align to the Oregon standards. All of these are available to be used in classrooms today. But when you're saying now that we have to mandate a particular course, it becomes much more expensive because we want to make sure it meets our standards. We want to make sure that no one has an advantage over the other. Some are commercial programs, some are for free. Some are, you know, there's all kinds of programs out there, and they're great programs. But for us to say that one of these is to be used over another is a very difficult decision, and would need to be done by Oregon teachers. So it would take panels working on that. We do believe it would have a significant fiscal impact to develop the course and to make the criteria beyond our standards.
Mm-hmm. Do we have a question, Senator Starr?
A comment.
Okay.
If your standards have been established, it would not take long to determine if any of these programs met those standards. It wouldn't take very many people very long to do that. It's interesting to me that we put up that kind of smoke screen when we're talking about something that's so important and so poorly executed in our system today, as attested to by the scores that students make. it just it's really beyond my understanding why we find it so difficult to implement something that's so widely available and even for free. That just disturbs me.
Senator, your point is well taken, because if we have this in our curriculum, why do we have students who are showing financial illiteracy on these tests? It's a good point. So we're going to hear from a teacher after we hear from Senator Cruz's question.
I guess I'm just confused as to why life skills are not part of STEM. If it's supposed to be this wonderful thing and then we don't have life skills as part of it, it just mystifies me. That's all.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is James Matisse, and I'm a teacher at Springfield High School. In fact, I teach in Senator Morissette's old classroom. So I'm pleased to see.
You mean they didn't bronze it and set it aside?
There is a little pagoda you have to walk through, but I'm pleased to see my senator chairing this committee as well. I testified over on the House side about this bill, and there I testify in opposition. Here, I'm a little more neutral because the way I read the bill, it doesn't sound like it's a requirement. I'm also pleased that Ms. Morgan is here as well, because we've emailed back and forth quite a bit over the last few years, and finally to meet her in person over curriculum issues. It's a good idea, and as people have testified earlier, the lack of financial literacy in this country and in this state is incredible, and along with lack of civic literacy and lack of geographic literacy and lack, I mean, we can go on and on to the things that we're lacking in terms of literacy. Two things. One, I'm glad my friends from the banking industry were here, and I'm glad that they are so concerned about students who are falling into bankruptcy. I hope they'll be here to support a bill limiting usury laws as well, or usury rates as well, when the time comes to help people out of bankruptcy. But one thing I would say, that if this curriculum does become required or even suggested, that issues of predatory lending, payday loans, credit card companies, things like rent to own, be not just mentioned in the curriculum, but be forcibly mentioned in the curriculum, so that all students are aware that these are not areas they want to go into. Most of the current personal finance curriculum that's out there mentions payday loans as maybe not a good idea. It really doesn't hammer home the fact of how dangerous these actually are. And I would also be aware of corporate ad placing in the curriculum, having someone sponsor a personal finance curriculum that really all it does, it's not creating better investors, it's creating better customers for that particular bank. And so those would be two things I would be very concerned about. I've taught economics for 9 years, seven of which here in the state of Oregon. And I teach, my economics class has always been a very hands-on, real-life type situation class. We used to have at Springfield High School, we had two personal finance teachers. And then in 1997, the legislature removed personal finance as a requirement. We kept those two personal finance teachers until budget cuts forced us to reduce them. And one went to the Teen Parent Center, and the other retired, and we didn't replace them. And so what then happened is we restructured the economics curriculum to add personal finance into it. So my economics class, which covered supply and demand and market forces and GDP and Measure 5 and the general fund and all kinds of issues that we're familiar with. And by the way, my students are still doing that. In fact, they are. The last assignment over break was to come up with $803 million for you folks. So we will have a report back at some point. But so we're still doing that. But what happened was my semester-long economics class was then infused with this personal finance curriculum, which used to be in a separate whole long semester-long class. And so now everything that I'm teaching gets scrunched down and room has to be made for this. And there's a man in Springfield named Curtis Greer who writes, it's a frequent letter to the editor-writer, and one of his issues is he wants to be able to bring his firearm on campus. The other issue is that he wrote a letter to the editor about 2 years ago, furious, because he'd gone to a bank, and the bank teller, he asked to cash a check, and he asked for the check to be returned to him in Federal Reserve notes. And the bank teller didn't know what he was talking about. And he blamed the entire education system for failing to teach this bank teller what a Federal Reserve note is. Now, we all know what a Federal Reserve note is. You know, we see it every day. I have never considered it absolutely essential to teach my students that this is a Federal Reserve note. I do now because of Curtis Greer. There's a lot of other things out there that Curtis Greer is mad at me because I didn't teach them. If you require more and more of these things to go into the curriculum, and we teach less and less what a Federal Reserve note is, what Measure 5 is, what the general fund is, what GDP is, these are important things to do. Everything that we've talked about is important, and we do financial literacy in the schools. But to set another unfunded mandate on top of us without providing the money, which is the definition of an unfunded mandate, is not going to make anything better. The last thing is when dealing with this curriculum, a lot of times you really have to evaluate the curriculum. This would be Ms. Morgan's job. The stock market game, for example, is this great tool because it's interactive. Just because it's on a computer doesn't mean students are going to learn from it. It's not going to guarantee that it's, because it has bells and whistles and makes noise and has good pictures, or you get to move things around, doesn't mean you're going to learn. And the stock market game is a great example. What students learn in the stock market game, which is always used as this personal and finance tool, oh, we'll teach them the stock market game. They'll learn all about investing. What they learn how to be is day traders. They don't learn how to be investors in lifelong savings. And so we have to be really careful with, if we subscribe to something that has a lot of bells and whistles, or it's very fancy, that we're actually teaching them something that is going to give them those skills. Lastly, as far as the issues of Senator Starr referenced smoke screens, and I don't know what goes on at ODE. I try not to know. I get told what to do and I do it. But I think it is a really valid point that if we're going to adopt curriculum, that there has to be measurable goals attached to it, and I'm sure that would take money to do. So, and that's sort of off the top of my head. That's just relating to the last comments. I believe other than that, I have a. One other question. As far as the test that I saw, the question was who joins unions and why. I assume the answer to that would be smart people. So, thank you.
I'll let you have that one, Mr. Matisse.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for your testimony. I, when you talked about unfunded mandates, it's not really an unfunded mandate because the program's free. You could say it's an unfunded mandate because we have to have the department develop the curriculum and pass on it. So that would be unfunded in that sense. Would you agree or disagree?
If I may, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the unfunded part comes when we stick it in the curriculum and we don't add FTE to teach that part. It takes away from something else that we're already doing. Or if we say, well, you have to do this as a whole semester-long class, then where do we find the teachers to teach that class?
You're already teaching it.
We're already teaching it embedded in the economics curriculum. We already are, yes. Okay. So I don't understand then.
Well, that's why I'm having trouble understanding where the unfunded mandate for you comes in. If you're already teaching a program, we just want everyone else to be teaching a program also. And I guess it's the quality of the program, whether the program is lengthy enough or in-depth enough. And I think that's where I'm sort of seeing where you're saying it's an unfunded mandate.
Right, if you require a longer program. Or I know, for example, North Eugene High School does a state government class. And if they had to replace that state government class with this, then we have an issue where we're losing civic literacy. So then the other option would be to create a new class, which would then be an unfunded mandate.
Yeah, I actually had a newspaper article up here, and now I've got all the stuff. I've lost it. But North Eugene High School had a program. One of the teachers out there developed that. I actually think I might have flipped that over to Marjorie to read. But this teacher thought it was so... here it is. Yeah. Eugene School District will... Here's an article from March 15, 2004. Courses in business and economics have all but disappeared as high school requirements and are growing rare even as electives. The Eugene School District will halt that trend next fall with an experimental new business prep class open to juniors and seniors at all four high schools. So that's not in your school district because you're in Springfield.
Neighboring, yeah.
North Eugene High School teacher Bill Temple designed a 27-week class and persuaded district officials to give it a try. Temple, a former businessman who turned to teaching 7 years ago, also will instruct the 20 to 30 students expected to sign up for the first year. So they're trying it in Eugene at each of the high schools, which would be this year. So I'm going to check in with School District 4J, see how that's going. They're about 3 or 4 months into the program, and see what they think about it. Senator Morissette?
Well, thank you, James. One of the problems that I've had is teaching state and local government, and what you have to do is you have to find a textbook, then you have to have teacher training, you have to have it recognized by the state, then you have to implement it. And it's very difficult, and they dropped personal finance at Springfield because they didn't have qualified teachers to teach them. That's one of the problems. And it's very difficult. So any course that they are required to teach, you have to do all of those things, and it's very expensive. And then you have to get rid of something else to do it. So I've learned that lesson.
And like I said, I'm not opposed to this idea, and I do it already in my classroom. It was a bit of a shift for me to going from an all economics curriculum to embedding this personal finance to learning to having to figure out what is it that you don't understand that 26% is a bad interest rate. I mean, there was that idea for myself. I consider myself a financially literate person, grew up in a household where I had financial literacy taught to me all the time, grew up in an area where, in which it was taught. A lot of my kids' parents, the parents use the social security numbers for their own because they're bankrupt, so they use their kids' social security numbers. The payday loans just devastate these families. Rent to own kind of places, and so it really is bringing teachers up to speed about what exactly it is that we need to teach these kids that they don't know, and that's the other part of it. So thank you very much for staying over.
And thank you, Mr. Matisse. And I just want the committee to know this is a very fine teacher. He really engages his students and is very active in the community. And I just appreciate that you made it up here.
Thank you, sir.
We are going to close this hearing, and thank you all for participating. So I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to hang on to the bill until I figure out what I want to do with it. And we are going to go into recess, adjourn. We're going to adjourn this committee until 6 p.m. Colleagues, so we're going to hear about sports supplements and defibrillators. So see you then.